This is Red Ice Creations Radio coming to you from the west coast of Sweden. My name is Henrik Palmgren and I want to thank you for tuning in to the program. Our website is redicecreations.com. We are growing every day. I want to thank everyone for your kind emails. We read all of it and we do our best to reply to as much of it as we can. So stay tuned to our website, of course, if you want to follow along in our news, listen to our radio program, watch some of our live webcasts, or see some of our video interviews or short films, or listen to some of the extended radio programs that we have up there for you. Today we have author Peter Russell with us on the line. His most recent book is From Science to God, a physicist's journey into the mystery of consciousness. And Peter is also a lecturer. He's given talks and written extensively on what I guess we can say is the mystery of consciousness and connecting the metaphysical to the physical. His website is simply peterrussell.com, where he has articles, videos, and books available for you. So I want to thank you very much for coming on the program, Peter. Nice to have you here.
It's nice to be with you. Thank you.
So why don't we begin, you know, talk a little bit about your background and some of the work, you know, that you've been doing over the years to give to build, I guess, a little bit of an image for our listeners, Peter.
Yes. Well, I mean, as the subtitle of my book suggests, it says a physicist. I started off being very interested in physics and mathematics, probably because I was very good at it as a child, and you go to university and you study what you're good at. And I still love physics, but there came a time in my study of physics where I realized it wasn't really answering some of the deep fundamental questions I had, which was basically, why is there consciousness in the universe? I mean, according to modern physics, the whole thing just should be unfolding by the laws of physics, and we can explain from that how chemistry evolved and biochemistry and how animals came into being. But why should any creature have an internal experience? I mean, I am, you know, listening to you now, I'm talking. All of that is a mechanical process. Why do we have this inner subjective experience? In a sense, you could say, why is there mind? We can understand everything about matter. But why is there mind in the universe? And we know there's mind for absolute certainty, because I mean, I know I have my mind, I have my thoughts, I have my feelings, I imagine things. Why did that happen? I realized physics was never, ever going to answer that question. And so I started becoming interested initially in psychology. I thought studying the brain would help. But I realized all that did was just allow me to understand the brain much better. But still, there was this question, why is there mind? Why is there consciousness? Mm. And I think that's really the mystery of consciousness. And a lot of my life has been around exploring that question. And also, how do we awaken consciousness? How do we become more conscious? Because in my journey, I ended up going to India and living in India for a while, because I felt the people there, the various yogis, spiritual teachers in India, knew a lot more about consciousness than we in the West did. And what became very clear for me there was that we are, in a sense, half awake in our consciousness. We are, you know, we have awareness, but so much of the time we are just functioning in our conditioned way. We're not really thinking for ourselves. We're not really aware why we're doing things. And so it became clear that one of the most important things was how do we wake up and become more conscious? Because I think so many of the problems that we see in the world today stem from the fact that we're living in a very limited, egocentric, short-term level of consciousness, and that clearly has to change. So really, a lot of my life and my writings and talks are around this question of, how do we become more conscious? What's that about?
Right.
That's the sort of brief survey of my life.
Yes. So maybe we can begin to talk a little bit about consciousness before we can move on and talk about how we can become more of it, so to speak, then. And how would you, you know, if I would ask you to, I guess, define or try to, you know, circle a little bit around consciousness in order to explain it better for us, what would you say?
Yes, I think circling around is a good idea, because it's actually very difficult to define. You can go to an English dictionary and you can find, you know, several different levels of consciousness, different meanings. You know, we talk about we're conscious when we're awake, and yet, you know, we say we're unconscious when we're asleep. And yet, if you think about it, when you're asleep, you have dreams. Dreams are experiences. They're happening in the mind. So there's some awareness. It's just we're not aware of the outside world, and often we're not aware that we're dreaming, but there's still awareness, or you wouldn't be dreaming. And so even when we're asleep, there is consciousness in that sense. So I'm talking about consciousness as the fact we are aware. It is what is always there, whatever we're experiencing, whatever we're doing, whatever's happening in the mind, the one common element that's always there is that we are conscious, we are aware. So I'm using consciousness in this general sense of an inner ability to be aware, to have experience. It's like it's the essence. It's the essence of any experience, is the fact that we are experiencing. So that's what I'm pointing towards, more than how we are conscious. You know, we could talk about somebody having a political consciousness or an environmental consciousness or a social consciousness. That's talking about how we are conscious. I'm more interested in the fact that we are conscious. So when I'm talking about consciousness, generally I'm pointing in that direction. Why is it that we have this inner awareness in the most general sense? And I don't think it's just human beings.
Sure.
I would say animals have it too. I mean, if you look at a dog, you know, when a dog's sleeping, it appears to be dreaming, and we imagine it's having experiences. When we see its sort of paws twitching, we imagine it's dreaming of chasing a cat or something. And
but I guess also when you're talking about consciousness, you're talking about more than just being awake and kind of responding to environment, right? You're talking more about actually making choices and things like that, right?
Yes, I think all of that is part of consciousness, the ability to make choice, the ability to respond. And being awake is one mode of consciousness, you could say. Being awake, being alert is one mode of consciousness. Dreaming when you're asleep is another way of being conscious. And we even know that people can have some experiences even when they're in a coma, when we would say, you know, they're completely unconscious. And yet, you know, we know they can recall some experiences sometimes. So it isn't, it's like the intensity of consciousness can get turned down, but it doesn't go out. A good analogy that's often used is like the light from a projector. When you watch a film or you're seeing, you know, a slideshow, you see many pictures on the screen, and they're all created out of the light from the projector, the light inside the projector shine through the film, and you see an image. And what is always there but we don't notice is the light. The light is always shining. We could turn the light down and the pictures would become dimmer. And I think it's the same with the mind. There's always this ability to be conscious. There's always awareness. We're not always aware of it. We don't always notice it, and it can be turned down very dim. But there's always something that's there. And it's that sense of being an experiencing person. That's another way to look at it.
So, I mean, where would you say that consciousness kind of comes from then? I think you had this interesting argument that consciousness kind of, it seems like cannot kind of arise from, you know, unconscious matter. Maybe you can talk about that a little bit.
Yes. I mean, this is the big question. This is the sort of $64,000 question or more that everybody is asking. And philosophers have been asking this question for hundreds of years, but it's really coming to a focus these days because we're becoming so much more knowledgeable about the brain and how the brain works. There's this question, where does consciousness come from? And the current scientific view, and it's almost not just the scientific view, but it's the view you find throughout our culture, and it's really just an assumption, is that somehow the activity in the brain creates awareness, it creates consciousness. Now, there's no doubt at all that what happens in the brain determines what we experience in our consciousness. And we know that if you stimulate a certain part of the brain, we have a certain experience. Take a certain part of the brain, if it's damaged, we lose a certain experience. So it's very clear, and we can monitor this with instruments. You know, if you ask a person to solve a mathematical problem, you see a certain part of the brain sort of lighting up. So it's very clear that what we experience depends upon the brain. But then we make the assumption that experience itself, that consciousness, that mind is created by the brain. And that's where you end up with this problem. It's often called the hard problem in philosophy. It's how does unconscious matter, we assume that matter is not conscious, that the nerve cells in the brain don't have minds, they're not conscious, and yet somehow all this unconscious matter gives rise to something which is totally different. The mind is not matter. You can't measure mind, you can't weigh it, but it's clearly there. We experience it. How does that happen? And people have many, many different theories. Some believe it comes from quantum processes. Others think it's something to do with the biochemistry of the brain. Others think it's to do with information processing. But all the different explanations, they all come up against this one big problem, is how does something that has no consciousness, no awareness, ever give rise to the total opposite, something that is an experience, that is awareness.
Yeah.
And so the view I've been exploring is a totally different one, is to say that maybe consciousness is always there, that everything has an element of mind. I mean, I was saying a dog is conscious. There's, you know, we have no doubt about that, but a dog is an experiencing being. It does not think like we do, but it's having experiences. And you can go down and say, well, you know, dog, maybe fish are, maybe insects are. Where do you draw the line? And the traditional view is, you know, somewhere when a nervous system reaches a certain level of complexity, it creates consciousness. But I think we can go all the way and say consciousness is always there to some extent. But as living systems get more complex, so the amount of consciousness becomes much richer. So human consciousness, I would say, is probably the richest, most diverse consciousness on this planet. But everywhere there is some inner aspect, however ever faint. That is a very unconventional view, but it actually does solve this problem of how does the brain create consciousness, because it says consciousness was always there. The brain isn't creating consciousness, it's really amplifying consciousness.
So what you're saying is that the more a refined and developed nervous system, including the brain and all that stuff, more advanced, so to speak, that is, the higher consciousness will kind of manifest within that system, right?
Yes, yes. And so, you know, we have a very exceedingly complex brain, which would also imply that things like whales and dolphins, which have even more complex brains,
yes,
may in some senses be even more conscious than we are.
When you ponder upon these questions, I don't know what your position is on that, but do you feel that consciousness is like one entity throughout the entire, you know, either universe or multiverse, and this is like we're like a small droplet of this bigger ocean of consciousness, or are we truly kind of unique individuals per se in regards to our consciousness? A very difficult question, but I don't know if you can elaborate that on that a little bit.
It's a difficult question, it's a complex question, and I think the simple answer is, in a way, both things are true. That on the one hand, we certainly have this individual experience. I mean, I experience what I call my consciousness, my mind, I have my thoughts and experiences, and they are clearly something that I have, you don't have. And so I sense this sort of individual identity. And yet, at the same time, when we're talking about consciousness in this general sense, just being aware, we could say that in itself is something that's universal. It isn't that it's all the same in essence. I mean, you mentioned like a drop. I think that's a very good analogy. analogy, the drop in water. You take a drop out of the ocean. It's an individual drop which has its own characteristics, its own shape, and yet its essence is water. And so that, you know, every drop you take out of the ocean, the essence is water, but it's an individual shape, it has its own characteristics. In the same way, you know, every individual being has its own mind, its own form of consciousness, and yet it is all composed of that same universal awareness. So in that sense, we are each a manifestation, our minds are a manifestation of something that is universal in character.
And what's your take on, let's say, life after death, or that our kind of awareness or consciousness then actually continues and lives beyond the boundaries of our body? What's your take on that?
I really don't know. It's I think an important thing for me is not to get caught up in any belief about what might be or might not be. I just have to say I don't know. There's interesting evidence that suggests that there may be some continuation, and yet I know there's nothing absolutely convincing for me. And, you know, different people all have different theories, people who believe in some continuation. There's so many different theories as to what it's like. Who knows which one is the right one? They can't all be right. So I just don't know. It's not something I can answer. It may be there is, and maybe just when we die, it's like the drop returns to the ocean and just, you know, becomes part of the infinite ocean again.
Yes, yes.
I suppose my interest is more, how do we live this life rather than what's going to happen after this life? And I think a lot of the wanting to believe in a life after this life is we become attached to our individual identity, and we really don't want to sense I'm going to lose what I call me, all the things I've done, my experiences, my goals. We identify with this individual drop, and we fear death and what's going to happen. And so we sort of, when that goes, and so we cling to this idea that, well, maybe it doesn't go, maybe
yes,
something continues.
Do you think that, because I kind of interpret that as a form of escape, if you will, then we're not, you know, really kind of focusing on the life we're living right now. We want to look beyond either the boundaries of this life or some kind of escape on this planet, of course, in that sense of entertainment or what have you. But do you think that the trouble we're in, that you talked a little bit about mentioning at the beginning here, the trouble that we're in, that this is a part of that in a way, that we're so wanting to escape into something else instead of just looking at life for what it is?
I think so, yes. I think it's all bound up, and I think so much of it comes from we start looking for escape or fulfillment. We look for things outside ourselves to make us feel okay, to make us feel happy. And, you know, it could be escape going into other sorts of experiences or realms, or hoping for something after we die. But also just, you know, in our day-to-day life, we look for the things, the experiences that are going to make us feel okay. So we're looking outside ourselves. And I think what I'm interested in is what all the great spiritual teachers have said in very different ways, but they're all pointing to the same thing, that the fulfillment we're looking for is really right there inside us the whole time, and we miss it because we're looking outside. We're chasing illusions, and we find some temporary satisfaction, and then we realize that was an illusion, and we keep on chasing these illusions rather than saying, hang on, is it possible for me to feel okay right now in the present moment?
Yes.
So rather, it's interesting, rather than pointing towards future lives, I think most of the great spiritual teachers point towards this moment now. How do we wake up? How do we become more conscious, more present
yes,
this moment?
And that's one of the hardest thing there is, isn't it? You know, to kind of be present in a way.
It's, again, these things are so full of paradoxes. It's one of the hardest things there is,
and
it's
the
easiest thing there is.
Yes.
I think we make it hard because we try to do it. We think there's somewhere to get to, and yet it's really just about stepping out of all the things that take us into the future or the past. Whenever we start thinking, we tend to be thinking about the future or about the past. It's about just noticing what is happening in the present moment. And again, so many people have found that if you just come back to your awareness of your body, you notice what's happening in my body. What's my breathing feel like? How does it feel to be sitting?
Well, we can carry on here. I mean, we were just talking about, I guess, kind of escape, and also of trying, you know, to be in the moment, really, or being more conscious. One thing that I'd like to mention, and I can give me your take on that, if you will, and that's that I feel that animals, in many cases, or even actually a flower or even a tree, to me, at least, is very much present or in the moment. What do you think about that, Peter? And that, I don't know if that would kind of contradict the idea of, with the more advanced nervous system comes higher consciousness. I don't know. What do you think, Peter?
Yes, I think you're right. I mean, I prefer just to sort of think of animals because it's easier to imagine what it's like for an animal. I think it's very hard to imagine the consciousness of a plant, because it's probably so different and probably so much fainter than ours. But if we take, you know, pets, I mean, we've all, I'm sure, you know, we know dogs and cats or horses, other mammals. They do seem to be much more present, in the sense that, you know, if a cat's got nothing to do, most of the time it just curls up and sleeps, or a dog will just sort of lie with its chin on the floor and watch the world. It doesn't start getting bored and saying, I've got nothing to do. And I think they are present much more of the time, not the whole time. I think what takes us out of being present is when there's something that needs our attention. There's some discomfort, we're hungry, we need to do something. And so, you know, an animal will at times be out of the present, and sometimes it may be upset if it's hurt. And you watch it, you know, if you're angry at a dog, it might be upset for 5 minutes, but then it seems to settle down again and forgets it. I think the difference with human beings is, because in some ways we are more conscious, because we can think and we can imagine the future, we create all these additional things to think about, to worry about, and that takes us out of the present. So this is the sort of, it's almost like the sad joke about human beings, because we are that much smarter, but we misuse our added intelligence to worry about things. What's going to happen tomorrow? Did I do the right thing yesterday? Or we think about the good things. Oh, that was good. And we relive something we did, or we imagine some fantasy of what's going to happen later in the day. We imagine a great restaurant we're going to. All these things fill up the mind and take us out of being present. I don't think a dog, you know, is sitting there on the floor thinking, well, tomorrow I really hope I'm going to have that food again, or I hope I'm going to go for that walk, or what a pity that last week this happened. And I, you know, it's like, it doesn't sit there thinking. And so thinking has made human beings something different. It's like, it's allowed us to do so much more. But the downside is it also traps our consciousness. It keeps us thinking about the past or the future, and so takes us out of the present.
Yeah.
And I don't think this happens to any other creature. This is what makes human beings different, and in a way is what makes us, in a sense, a dangerous species on the planet, because it's broken our connection with nature. We end up living in our minds more than just being in the present moment in our bodies.
Do you simply believe that this is a side effect of the evolutionary process that we are in, or do you think that something has, because there certainly are plenty of kind of ideas why the human being or man has been kind of separated, if you will, from nature and gotten into this particular mindset. Do you have a theory or idea about that?
Yes, I think it's a side effect of the evolutionary process, and it's an inevitable side effect. It's part of the I see as part of the awakening process that in our evolution, we started becoming conscious of ourselves, conscious that we are aware, that we have a mind. And that has been a step forward. And I think this has been helped a lot by the fact, as I've been mentioning, that we have language, that we can talk to each other, but also that we can talk to ourselves. And a lot of thinking is talking to ourselves about things, planning things, analyzing things, which is a very, very useful thing. If we didn't have that, we would just be like, you know, like the other great apes. And it's interesting, it's been shown that once you start teaching apes languages, they immediately start becoming more like human beings. It's there. But I think having language has made us different. And so it's almost like the downside of language is that we get caught up in this thinking process where, if I look at my thoughts, probably 90% of what I think is totally unnecessary. Most of it is a repeat. It's not helping me at all, but it's like a habit. So I think it's an inevitable part of becoming more conscious. And I think it's only also a temporary part of becoming more conscious. And this is where I feel the sort of the world's wisdom traditions, spiritual traditions, philosophies come in, is that they see we have to move through this and move on into a way where we're not so dominated by our thinking. Really, it's about how do we come back to being present again and not be totally caught up in the thinking. So yes, although it's an inevitable part of the journey of awakening, I think it's something we have to come through and come out on the other side of so that we can begin to use thinking constructively but not be trapped by it.
So you're saying that basically that we're not complete, right? We're on a journey here. We're still developing, and things are probably going to get, hopefully then, better, right?
Yes, I think that's a very good way of putting it. We're halfway through this journey of awakening. And so many of, you know, these inner teachings talk about ways to quieten the mind. It's almost a universal thing. How do we quieten the mind, whether it's through, you know, meditation or music or dance or prayer, whatever it is, it's ways of allowing the mind to settle down again. Our whole society is like encouraging us to think, to be active mentally, which is good in some ways, but we also need to find ways to allow the mind to become quiet again so that we can just settle in to our own being. And I think that's what we're missing. And that's the next challenge in our evolutionary process, is how do we recapture that essential being? How do we just come back to feeling quiet in the moment, whatever's going on?
Yes. And I would very much agree there in regards to society that it's good in that sense, because it obviously all things teach us things, of course, but it's also very much distractive in that process. Now, you mentioned that we are kind of moving into this direction, and the question that arises then is, of course, if this has anything to do with the time, meaning that, oh, you know, let's just wait here another couple of, 100 years or something, or everything will be good again. Or do you think that we're talking about, are we in the situation rather right now where we actually can take these next evolutionary steps in our own hands and begin to change it already, if you will?
Yes, I think we are. And I think that's what I find is exciting about these times now. And there's two sides of this. From one side, I think what we are seeing and what is going wrong in so many aspects of the world today comes back to the fact that we are caught. I mean, right now everybody's talking about sort of the global economic meltdown.
Yeah.
And we can see how, you know, one major factor in that has been human consciousness. It's been human greed or human beings not wanting to think about where this is going in the future, wanting, you know, more for ourselves in the moment. If we'd had a different mode of consciousness over the last 100 years, I don't think we'd be in this situation. So we're becoming aware that there's something in our thinking, the way we approach the world, our attitude. issue that needs to change. So there's a push that's gently beginning to happen to say, hey, the old way of being, the old way of relating to the world isn't working. Hmm. And at the same time, I think just over the last 20, 30 years, there's been this growing interest throughout the developed world, the people who have the time, the luxury to begin to explore other things. There's been this sort of wanting to look at ourselves and see how we can develop ourselves. And, you know, whether it's at a very simple level of people, you know, doing yoga, practicing meditation, doing workshops that help them open up to a deeper understanding of themselves, or just through reading books to help them understand themselves better. There is this movement towards waking up to who we really are. And I see it as a widespread movement, and we're all helping each other in a way. I mean, I write books and give talks, but I also read other people's books and listen to other people's talks and have conversations with people, and that helps me. And I think we're all doing this. We're all, in a way, helping each other gradually wake up to who we really are. And this, I don't think, was really possible in the past. And it's partly because we have, you know, telecommunication, the fact that right now I can talk to you about this from California.
Yes.
100 years ago, you know, we could get together in a house or a town hall in a town, or we could talk to people in our community. Now we can share ideas globally, and we can see this sort of what I call the universal wisdom that I think is there in all cultures. We can begin to see what that underlying wisdom is. And as we do, I think we're beginning to create a new sort of 21st century understanding of what this inner journey is about. Mm. And I think it's happening faster and faster as more and more people begin exploring this inner journey, and as more and more people discover things and we share with each other, it grows faster and faster. So my feeling is this could, you know, I think we're probably talking our own lifetimes.
Really?
Rather than 200, 300, 400 years or thousands of years of evolution.
Mm-hmm. What would you say kind of would propel that along? Because when I'm seeing some of the discoveries that are being made either within physics or even biology, or, you know, deciphering the human genome, it feels like a lot of people from the more metaphysical realm are actually kind of picking up on that knowledge and putting another interpretation on that than the mainstream scientists are. And I feel that that's very kind of enriching, and it we learn a lot from that. What do you think, Peter?
Yes, I don't. I mean, I suppose being a scientist originally, I'm fascinated by what is being discovered in terms of the human genome, and I think it's still very, very early. I think we're going to be in for some major, major discoveries. I don't feel like some people say, oh, we can change our genome by thinking, by our consciousness. I don't feel that. I'm probably too materialist at heart for that. But I think there's so much yet to be discovered around the genome. And also in physics. I mean, I'm fascinated by what's happening in modern physics. And again, I think we're going to start discovering things about consciousness there. The whole of quantum physics is intimately connected with knowing and consciousness in ways that we haven't yet worked out. I think that's why there's still a lot of confusion around quantum physics.
Yeah.
It's because we are trying to understand it purely from a physical point of view, rather than seeing that in quantum physics there is this intrinsic relationship to knowing, to consciousness. And until we understand consciousness, I don't think we're going to really fully understand what quantum physics is about.
Ah, interesting. And that kind of leads us into an area that I did want to talk a little bit about. That is basically, you know, what matter is, so to speak, because I wanted to kind of ask you if you consider the real world that we're living in to be something real, or if you think that the space or the confinement that we're in simply is a kind of a construct of our own brains. What do you think?
Again, my answer is both. It's funny. I mean, I think in all these areas.
Right.
On the one hand, yes, there is an external world. There's something, you know, when I touch a bookshelf here, I'm touching something that feels physically solid. There is an external world. There's no doubt about that. But I think we do not experience it as it really is. And so our experience of the external world is a creation in our own mind. I mean, if I'm seeing, you know, I'm looking out the window, I'm seeing some grass, I'm seeing green. The light that is coming from the grass to my eye isn't actually green light. We call it green light. It's actually light that's just a certain frequency, a certain wavelength, a certain energy. It hits the eye, it triggers electrical impulses. Those impulses aren't green impulses. They're just certain frequencies that travel down certain nerves. And the brain then creates its picture. And the image arises in my mind, in consciousness, of the color green. But what we see here is the greenness is only actually in the mind. It's a quality of consciousness. It's not actually out there in the physical world. And this applies to everything in the world. We take what is out there. We take the incoming data, the energy that's coming in, whether it's through the eyes or when I hear a sound, the energy of air moving against my ear creates nervous impulses. And my brain translates that as hearing music or hearing the wind or hearing the voice. But that, again, is all in my mind. So we have this situation where what I perceive as reality is totally a construction in my mind based upon the reality out there. But the reality out there isn't like my experience. And I think this is the first thing. We confuse the two. We think that I am seeing the world directly. We're seeing it as it is. What we're seeing is the construction in the mind. And in a way, science doesn't doubt this whatsoever. I mean, we spend so much time and energy analyzing how the brain creates its experience. We know this.
Yes.
That the brain is constructing its own experience. And so in that sense, even what we think of as matter is a construct in the mind. I mean, this is hard to get because it seems so obvious that things seem solid.
Yes.
But what modern physics is showing is that there's, in a sense, nothing there. When we get down to it, you know, what is an atom? It's like mostly empty space with electrons, protons flying around each other. And what are they? They aren't even matter as we think of it. They aren't particles. They aren't little tiny lumps of matter. That's just a way of thinking about it. All we know is there's some potentiality there for something to appear in a certain way. It's like there's nothing there. And I think what we do is we take our experience, and in our experience we think of particles. We have that in our experience. And we imagine that's what the real physical world is like. But what we're discovering is it's very, very different, and there's nothing actually substantial there.
Yes.
I mean, the reason my hand won't go through this piece of wood is because the forces, the electrical forces which hold all the molecules in my finger together, won't penetrate the electrical forces that hold all the atoms of the wood together. So there's a big resistance there. And in fact, as we know, if you put really high pressure on things, really high pressure, you can actually make matter pass through matter if you put sufficient pressure mm-hmm. to overcome those forces.
Have they done those kind of experiments?
Yes. You can take like a piece of metal and push it against another metal, and the atoms begin to sort of break through the force. It takes very, very high pressure.
Yes.
But they sort of break through, and it's one way of sort of welding things together. You push them so they begin to, the atoms begin to penetrate each other, but you have to use huge pressure because you've got to overcome these very strong electromagnetic forces that hold all the bits together.
Interesting.
So it's like, yes, to us the world appears very solid physical matter, and yet in the final analysis we know it isn't actually solid, isn't actually matter. all our concepts of matter are just concepts which we've created in terms of our own experience of matter. And what modern physics is showing is none of our concepts actually apply to the real nature of the world. It's fascinating. But that doesn't mean to say we just say, oh, there's no matter out there. It's clear that, you know, the way we experience it as matter. We experience the grass as green.
Yes.
And that's how we live our lives. So this is more like understanding that we live in this created experience, which is very different from the real nature of things.
Did you see this news story just a few days ago here that talked about that scientists have kind of confirmed at this point, or they have understand now where mass actually comes from? Did you see that article?
Where mass comes from?
Yeah.
No, was this to do with the Higgs boson?
Well, this is actually more about the quarks and the gluons, actually.
No, I didn't see it. That's interesting. I've missed that one. I've probably come across it soon. I'll go and chase it. Can you briefly say what it was?
Yeah, I can read the first two paragraphs here quickly and get your take on it, if you will, here.
Yes.
It says, the standard model of physics got it right when it predicted where the mass of ordinary matter comes from. According to a massive new computation effort, particle physicists physics explains that the bulk of atoms is made up of protons and neutrons, which are themselves composed of smaller particles known as quarks, which in turn are bound by gluons. The odd thing is, the mass of gluons is zero, and the mass of quarks accounts for only 5%. Where, therefore, is the missing 95%? And it goes on to say here, the answer, according to theory, is that energy from the interaction between quarks and gluons accounts for the excess mass, because as Einstein's famous E equals mc squared equation proved, energy and mass are equivalent. Gluons are the carriers of the strong nuclear force that binds three quarks together to form one proton or neutron. These gluons are constantly popping into existence and disappearing again. The energy of these vacuum fluctuations has to be included in the total mass of the proton and neutron. The new study finally crunched the numbers on how much energy is created in these fluctuations and confirmed the theory, but it took a supercomputer over a year to do so. So basically what I'm getting out of this is that basically because of these fluctuations, as it's called, basically energy in that sense, that is what matter is, really, if you boil it down. What's your take on it, Peter?
It makes a lot of sense. It sounds right to me. That's all. I mean, I'd love to go and explore it more.
Yes.
Yes, it's like, and again, it's saying that what gives it its mass, it doesn't have intrinsic mass, but the mass is something that appears out of the processes that are going on.
Yes, exactly.
So I think, yeah, that's fascinating. I think, again, you know, our human experience is that we believe that things have intrinsic mass, and that's been part of our conditioning. And, you know, physics for a long time has taken that and applied it to the real world, not realizing, hang on, it works very differently. This makes a lot of sense, yes.
Yes.
Mass is something that appears through that energy coming and going.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
yeah, I must follow that up. Thank you.
Yeah, definitely. I can send you that link if you're interested, and you can read it yourself more with detail, as it were. But the question that arises, this thing about, you know, returning to the idea of reality, then, because to me, that means that there really, potentially at least, isn't such a thing as a kind of objective reality. But at least from our own point of view, from our individual point of view, there can only be that kind of subjective interpretation, if you will, of reality. So the question is, you know, do we make a lot of stuff up, you know, in the world that people don't see, you know, and because that's a pretty, you know, interesting thought, if you will, that there is really is potentially nothing as an objective reality as such. What do you think about that?
Yes, I think it's a question of words here. I mean, as I said earlier, I think there is a reality out there which we call objective reality, and that reality is composed, you know, as you're talking about, quarks and gluons interacting, gluons coming in and out of existence. There's a reality there we're beginning to understand, but that is nothing like the reality we live in. So the reality we know is the construct in the mind that we live in.
Yes.
And the two have a relationship. If the reality out there changes, if a certain configurations in gluons and quarks and things change, then that creates something different in the physical world, and we see that differently. So, you know, if all the atoms in a blade of grass change and it changes its color and dies, we see that, we experience it. So our experience is related to this external world, but the two are very different in nature. So my feeling is it's not to say there is no objective reality, but we can never know it. Never actually know what it's like. We can think about it, but we never experience it directly. All we ever experience is the reality that appears in our mind.
How about, I'll start to cut you off there, continue.
No, go on.
Okay, I just wanted to ask, do you think that a tool or an instrument or a device will be able to read it, or do you still that that's, do you think that that's is still kind of you know, under, you know, the, I don't know how to phrase this, the our you know, our perception or our consciousness, meaning that if we look at the instrument that is looking at reality, we're still having that filter you know, between ourselves and reality, so to speak?
Yes, I think there'll always be that filter. We, you know, we can develop very sophisticated microscopes. We have microscopes now that can see individual atoms, or they can detect individual atoms. But again, all that we know is we take the data coming from that instrument, and then we see a picture or something.
Yes.
So I think there's always that filter, and I think it's inevitable. That's always going to be the way it is.
Yes. You had a pretty interesting theory, I guess, or idea about the nature of light. I saw this primacy of consciousness, a little bit of a clip that you have available on your website, and you talked a little bit about, I guess, the nature or actually what light is. Maybe you can just briefly talk about that.
Yes, and also before I forget, you mentioned my website. One thing I should say for European audiences, there's two letter L's on the end of Russell. Often Europeans spend, you know, spell Russell with one L. But if you do that, you go to a different website. So it's Peter Russell with two L's at the end.
Okay, yes.
Otherwise, people end up somewhere strange and think, what? Who is this guy?
Right, right.
But yes, there's a whole piece on light, and it's in my book, From Science to God, as well. And this comes out of something I was fascinated by when I was studying physics years ago. And one of my great interests was Einstein's theory of relativity. And what the theory of relativity predicts, and it's been shown to be true, even though it doesn't feel like common sense. And this is what's interesting, is often when we get down to the real nature, it's not like common sense. Common sense is what applies to our experience. That as you go faster, as things travel faster, they both get heavier, their mass increases, and secondly, the experience of distance shortens, but thirdly, time begins to slow down. So something that's traveling very fast past me, if I observe its clocks are going much slower than mine. And the theory of relativity predicts that if anybody ever traveled at the speed of light, that time would stop completely. Now, you know, people say you don't have to worry about that because we can never travel at the speed of light, which is true because our mass would become infinite at the speed of light. But nevertheless, the theory predicts anything traveling at the speed of light, there would be no time and it would appear to travel no distance. Now, light, by definition, travels at the speed of light. It is the speed of light. So we could say from light's point of view, and this is what physicists talk about, is how does the universe look from different points of view? From light's point of view, there is no time. It lives in a timeless realm, so to speak, and there is no distance. It doesn't actually travel anywhere. It's just, it's a point of interaction between two points in the universe. And I found this fascinating two perspectives. One, there's a lot of talk in physics about, you know, is light a wave or a particle?
Yes.
So from our point of view, we're saying, how does light get from A to B? Does it travel as a wave? Does it travel as a particle? and sometimes it seems to be one, sometimes neither, sometimes the other. If you look at it from light's point of view, which probably is the only way we should really look at light, it doesn't travel anywhere, it doesn't take any time, it doesn't need to be either a wave or a particle, it's just a transfer of energy. A direct, immediate transfer. But from our point of view, we see there's time involved, we see space involved. So I think that's one thing that comes out of it, is a whole new understanding of what light is, when we realize that light lives beyond time and space.
Yes.
And the other thing that really fascinated me by this was the relationship between light in the physical world and the fact we use light to talk about consciousness. You know, we talk about the light of consciousness.
Yes.
You know, we talk about the inner light. If someone's unconscious, we say the light went out. Or, you know, we have an inspiration. You know, I had a flash of inspiration. I saw the light. And the way I was talking about consciousness at the beginning of the program, like the light that's in the projector, the light that's always there, the light in our mind. A similar thing happens when you just come down to pure consciousness, and this is what happens in techniques of meditation and other things. When the mind becomes very, very still, there is nothing happening. There are no thoughts, but you are still aware, you're still awake, but the mind is very still. Then you enter what many of the mystics call this sort of timeless, eternal realm, where time seems to just disappear. And also your sense of space tends to disappear. And it just struck me there's a very interesting parallel here between light in physics and light in the mind, that both seem to have this element of time not being real. Mm. Time somehow seems to be a creation in the material world. It implies that time is not the absolute that we tend to think it is.
That's very interesting. And okay, so we'll take a short pause here in a little bit then. But before we continue, I want to that you mention your website, and you can give us the right spelling so people don't go to the wrong place, so to speak. And also mention a few of your titles and DVDs that you have available on your site.
Yes. Well, the website is just my name, peterrussell.com, which is P-E-T-E-R, then R-U-S-S-E-L-L.com. That's just peterrussell.com. My books, the one you mentioned, the most recent one, is From Science to God, where I look at a lot of the questions we started out with, you know, how do we explain consciousness and the problems that science has with explaining how consciousness comes out of the brain, and then it goes into more of what we'll probably come on to talking about later, which is how do we awaken consciousness. And it's partly my own journey from someone who was interested in physics only to someone who starts getting much more interested in these ideas. The book before that was called Waking Up in Time, which is much more about the evolutionary picture we talked about, how we got here, but also about the acceleration of evolution, how things are going faster and faster and faster, and where that's taking us. And then the book which I'm probably actually most well known for is The Global Brain, which I wrote about 25 years ago.
That long ago?
25 years ago, just the 25th anniversary, which was, it was written before the internet really existed, and I was seeing how the internet would come into being and how it would start linking us together into this planetary culture, and looking at what that meant for the planet as a whole. It brings in the whole idea of Gaia as a living organism. And again, touches on the shifts in consciousness that we're being asked to make as we move into this whole new world. And I've written some other books on meditation and things. You can find them all on the website. And my DVDs, there's a DVD of The Global Brain, which you can watch a version on the website. There's another one called The White Hole in Time, which is similar to Waking Up in Time. It was the original title, and that is very much, that's a video around the acceleration. And there's I've got CDs, they're audio tapes, audio MP3s you can listen to on meditation, because one of the things I like to do is teach meditation as a way of helping the mind settle down. And so there's various meditations on the website.
So again, peterrussell.com. I will have this linked up, of course, on redascreations.com, so you can go over to Peter's website and check out some of the material that he has up there for you. And in our next segment here, I do want to talk more about then how we can become more conscious, or how we awaken consciousness. And also, this will definitely get us into some of the material about meditation and so forth. And if there's time, and if you want to go there, of course, Peter, I'd love to briefly talk about the global brain a little bit, because I think that's really interesting. So so stay with us here, Peter. I will take a short break, and we'll continue shortly.
Okay.
Thank you. Stay tuned. In our members section, we're going to talk more about how to awaken consciousness, how to be more present, observant, and in the moment. We're also going to get into Peter's fascinating theory about the global brain. This has to do with the growth of the internet and the number of people currently on the planet. The question is if this is creating a new awareness. And how about the more scary areas of the brain-computer interfaces? If we all go along with that kind of stuff, will it be another form of escape, another illusion that will immerse ourselves in? Or can we learn and grow from that kind of technology? RedEyesCreations.com is our website. Go there for more information on how to join us in the member section. Also to mention, of course, that Architects of Control is now out. Program 1, Mass Control and the Future of Mankind. We're very pleased to announce that the DVD is now available. And this is produced by Red Eyes Creations, Michael Tesserion, and Blue Fire Film. And you can get your copy today at architectsofcontrol.com. More coming up now with Peter Russell.
Michael Tesserion and Blue Fire Film presents the long-awaited DVD film, Architects of Control.
Architects of Control.
Program 1, Mass Control and the Future of Mankind, now available at architectsofcontrol.com.
Check. Check out your mind.